1 o'clock.
91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Do you think Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn are just fads? Well, think again. Whether you like it or not, social media is here to stay. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Today we look at the legal perils and permissions of social media with attorney and author Ethan Hall. He's a social media legal expert and adjunct professor of social media and the law at Nova Southeastern University. Among other questions, what can and can't employees say about their employers on social media? And more, Linda Gassenheimer chats with Claudine Pepin, daughter of world-renowned chef Jacques Pepin, about her book, Kids Cook French. Stay with us. Topical Currents up next after the news.
And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman.
Feeling better, Joe?
Thursday afternoon. Well, thanks for soloing those 2 days. I had a little bug. I'm back barely. But glad to be back.
Glad you're back.
Well, today's topic is very interesting. Social media has exploded into our constant awareness. Its development churns up many questions, however. What are the legal perils and who gives legal permissions?
We begin today with author, social media legal expert, and Nova Southeastern University adjunct professor of social media and the law, Ethan Wall. He's the author of a few books, including Fire Over Facebook, which has the longest title ever, so I won't say the whole thing just now. Welcome, Ethan.
Thanks for having me.
And great to have you. Okay, let's start here. I am fascinated why there are so many legal issues surrounding social media, and you had to create this course at NSU titled Social Media and the Law, Lawyers, Laws. What is it?
Well, that's something I've been trying to answer for about 8 years now, is what is social media law? I mean, everyone is on social media today, including my mom. And I know this because this morning my mom liked my Facebook post. And so when our forefathers drafted our Constitution, MySpace didn't exist, or Snapchat or Facebook. And so part of the issue is, how do we apply all of these existing laws to these new technologies? Because technology and social media is advancing much faster than the law can adapt.
I'm just curious if there are as many legal issues around social media in other countries as there are in the United States.
Absolutely. And the problem that so many lawyers and regulators and legislatures and business people are trying to answer is, if I operate my business partially here in the United States and also in Europe and other countries, how are these laws going to apply? Because we have a complex legal structure here and we're doing the best job we can in the United States to apply these laws to how we operate business in the United States.
If I'm not a public figure, and someone slanders me on Facebook, is that considered published and therefore subject to libel laws?
Absolutely. So one of the first cases that involved out of Twitter was a case against Courtney Love, who tweeted to all of her Twitter followers some pretty offensive things about one of her former designers. And the question was, is that defamation? Is that libel or slander? And legal scholars who looked at this particular case said, absolutely. You were able to establish, just based upon the number of Twitter followers that someone has, that the statement was published to a number of third parties, and so long as it was factual and it was defamatory, they would have a legal claim.
So what you say on Facebook is the same as what you might write in a newspaper.
And even worse, because once it's in a newspaper, it's in a fixed copy.
And goes away.
Exactly. Or over time, sure.
When you mentioned about the number of followers, does that also determine, I mean, is it by the numbers? If you have a certain number of followers, then it's defamation? Or it doesn't matter.
It could be to one.
Okay.
One Twitter follower. As long as it's one third party. You can't say the defamatory statement, let's say, and I'd never say this, obviously, but let's say I was making a defamatory statement about Joseph. He wouldn't have a claim if it was just Joseph and I speaking, whether it was in person or maybe via Facebook Messenger. But once
Messenger.
I tell
okay.
it to you, Bonnie, now okay. you're a third party, now a claim for defamation might potentially kick in.
Okay, so you argue that every company, every business needs and should have a social media policy. Now, is that in the best interests of the employee or the employer or both?
Little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. So it's absolutely in favor of the employer because there are things that our employees can say that can get us or our companies in serious legal trouble. Through a legal theory called vicarious liability, employers can be responsible for the harassing, defamatory, or illegal things that our employees say. And so it serves the best interest of employers to have a policy so that if an employee says something wrong, then they're able to fire them for their inappropriate content. But it's almost equally as important for employees because as employees, we don't want to get in trouble. We don't want to say bad things, but sometimes we just don't know what's okay and what's not okay. So by having a policy and training our employees on the right things to say online, it could provide some peace of mind and a level of comfort to employees. But of course, once that policy is in place and once an employee's been trained, they're in a much weaker legal position by saying something wrong online.
Okay, so what if an employer has rules governing what an individual can or can't say on social media that violate the law?
Then the employer can get into serious legal hot water.
Give an example.
Okay, so they, of course, an employer wants to have a policy that says that employees can't say harassing or discriminating things about fellow employees or the company or customers, that makes sense. A reasonable policy might say that all employees cannot say defamatory statements about the company or its managers. That policy, however, is illegal. And the reason why it's illegal is that employees do have the right to say harmful things about a company or about a manager, so long as that statement is true. And if they didn't...
Which is the classic libel defense.
Exactly. And so,
so if they were complaining about their salary, for example.
100%. Or maybe they're complaining about how their manager treats them. And they say, it's so unfair that my manager makes me come in on the weekends. He is such a jerk. I'm overworked and this is not okay. The manager might run into his supervisor's office and say, we have a policy. This violates the policy and we must fire them. But the employee might have a right to say those things so long as what they're saying is true and they're sharing it with other employees on social media.
But that's so subjective when you say my manager's a jerk. So he may think it's true, but the manager may not think it's true.
Of course. And so just the statement my manager is a jerk is probably not going to be protected. But the question becomes, what's the context of that statement? If it's my manager's a jerk because he makes me work on weekends, it doesn't make Sally work on weekends or other people, then the fact that they called the manager a jerk is not likely going to lose protection under the act so long as the complete statement is protected and it was communicated to other employees.
What if it was said my manager's a jerk and he's having an affair?
Well, now that statement is not going to be protected under the National Labor Relations Act, and here's why. The National Labor Relations Act is a federal law that provides employees with the rights to engage in what's called protected and concerted activities. That means that an employee has an equal right to talk around the water cooler, as they do on Twitter, about the shared terms and conditions of their employment. So in the first instance about working on weekends, that's a protected communication potentially because it has to do with the shared terms and communications of employment, meaning the fact that one employee was working on weekends and the other is not. The fact that the manager may have had an affair and is otherwise a jerk has absolutely nothing to do with the shared terms and conditions of their employment. It's instead an individual gripe that this one employee has about this one manager, and therefore a statement of that nature I don't think is ever going to be protected under the National Labor Relations Act.
Okay, so let's say they say something that is protected. You know, I have to work on weekends, Sally doesn't, my manager is a jerk, and they fire him.
There can be grave legal consequences, because what's going to happen is the manager is going to run into the supervisor's office, or some other employee is going to bring this to the manager's attention and they're going to fire this employee.
Right.
And what will happen is if the employee wins a legal case for an unfair firing, saying that you fired me based upon my protected activity, we know that the legal system doesn't happen overnight.
Right. So how long are we talking about here?
It depends. It's one of the most difficult questions we have as lawyers and how long a case can take. But on average, for a federal court case, which is a case where the National Labor Relations Act would be filed under, you're looking at least 12 months and more likely 18 months to 2 years potentially to resolve a claim, because it has to first go through the National Labor Relations Board, then potentially an appeal in federal court. And so let's say this one employee who is maybe being paid $50,000 a year was out of work for a year while they won this lawsuit. They're going to get entitled to their back pay, all of their benefits, their seniority in the workplace. They have to be rehired, plus prejudgment interest, meaning this employee is going to walk back into that job with a chip on their shoulder and their head held high, knowing that they won this lawsuit and they get paid all this back money.
And they can't be retaliated against.
Not legally. Now, of course, things are going to happen in the workplace.
There can be subtleties.
There certainly could. But under the law, they are not allowed to retaliate against that employee.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with Ethan Wall from Nova Southeastern University, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. Also, email radio@wlrn.org.
Okay. Staying on the Facebook, for example, are prospective employees required to provide access to prospective employers about their activity on social media? I mean, do they have to give access?
Mm-hmm.
I guess some of it's just so public, though, they wouldn't even need permission.
Right. So an employer has the right to view someone's public social media profiles, and they don't have to ask permission to access anything that's public. However, an employer might expose themselves to potential anti-discrimination claims by reviewing even someone's public Facebook profile. Meaning, if I were to come in to WLRN and want a job here, and you can ask me certain amounts of questions during the interview process, but you can't ask me, am I married? Am I single? Am I straight? Am I gay? What's my religion? Those are protected information that you can't base a hiring decision off of. Now, the moment that you search for an applicant on social media, you become exposed to all of this protected information. Even if you don't base a hiring decision on it, you now know, are they Jewish? Are they Christian? Are they Muslim? Are they straight? Are they gay? Do they have potentially a genetic disorder? Are they a former member of the United States military? So employers must be very careful about who views the social media profiles of their applicants. And now towards the law that you asked for, which is, can an employer require an employee to turn over their Facebook username and password? The answer is, it depends on the state. So currently, there are at least 18 states across the country that have enacted a law that prohibits an employer to require an employee to turn over their Facebook username and password. Here in Florida, there is no current law at the moment. However, there is now a second bill that's working its way through the legislature. The first one a few years ago died in the legislature because there was some ambiguity on the exceptions to that rule. But that act has now been revived in a new way, so stay tuned because the law might be changing.
Okay, but you said you have to be very careful who at the company views the Facebook page, because they could determine, you know, their sexual preference, their religion, you know, whatever, but they don't have to admit that that's why they didn't hire them.
That's true. So there is
could lie.
And you know what? People lie all the time. And so there's a new seminal case that's out there called Gaskill versus the University of Kentucky. And in this case, there was a professor who was up for tenure, and the review board for the university was vetting him as a potential tenured candidate. It looked at his social media accounts as part of it and saw that he was ranting about some religious issues out in the Middle East. He was then not hired, and he brought an unfair labor claim saying, or excuse me, an anti-discrimination claim saying, you viewed my Facebook page, I put information about my religious preferences, and that's why you didn't hire me. Now, the university exactly said what you said, Bonnie, which is, this had absolutely nothing to do with your religious preferences. And so when it got in front of a judge, the judge denied the university's motion to dismiss the lawsuit on the grounds that it is at least possible that some of that information was considered. It even denied what's called summary judgment, which is viewing all the facts in the light most favorable to the university. There had to be a trial to decide whether they reviewed that information and considered it or not.
What if said employee was trumpeting on Facebook about the virtues of ISIS?
Well, now...
Because it's a terror act. Under the Terrorist Act, he can be denied a position, obviously.
That's true. So there is a razor-thin line between what is a religious view, what might be considered terrorism. And so if you are an employer and you found yourself in this situation, you're already behind the eight ball because you should have had a policy in the first place that clearly explained that while employees are allowed to talk about religious issues, there are certain things that shouldn't be talked about, such as terroristic acts or discrimination or harassing comments that might harm other people. And so if there was a policy in place beforehand, the employer would be in a much better position to take appropriate action by potentially not hiring that employee who's talking about ISIS. But if they didn't have a policy in the first place, it then becomes very unclear of whether the employee had a right to do so or not.
Is it legal for employees to conduct their social activity, social media activity, during business hours on their business computers?
So for the most part, the answer is no. It also depends upon the state. But the National Labor Relations Act also affords employers with rights. And it's okay, generally speaking, under the National Labor Relations Act to say that employees cannot use social media to communicate on personal matters during work time on work computers in work areas. But a policy that might be overbroad is one that says you can't use social media during work because an employee may have the right to use social media in non-work times, such as on a break or during lunch, and in non-work hours, such as on their own personal cell phone. So while we want to protect from employees wasting time and resources and energy playing around on Facebook and Pinterest and Instagram and Snapchat, we also want to be sure that our policies are not so overbroad to infringe upon that limited fundamental employee right.
Let's take a phone call or two. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. We are a little short on time. Benjamin in Miami. Hi there.
Hey, I just had a quick question about the comments you made about, I guess the specifics was, you know, calling the boss a jerk that you have to come into work on a Saturday and that that might be protected speech. Is that dependent on whether you're in a unionized environment and whether you're at a at-will employment environment? I mean, where's the line there? Can a boss just say, well, I don't want to have an employee that works for me that is going to call me a jerk, so he's going to go?
It's a great question, Benjamin. And one of the biggest misconceptions about the National Labor Relations Act is that it only applies in unionized states, and that is not the case. It does govern union activity, but also non-union activity. So the fact that someone is not a member of a union and works in a state like Florida, which is a at-will employment state, the National Labor Relations Act still does apply. And so while an employee can be fired for no cause, such as the sky's blue, I don't want you to work for me anymore, you can fire someone for that in Florida. But once that firing infringes upon an employee's protected right under federal law, the employer can still get in trouble. So the question is, of course, no employer wants an employee is going to call them a jerk. But if the employer is also speaking with other employees about a shared terms and conditions of their employment, the employer must be very careful before they fire them.
Is somebody who does take legal action less prone to ever get another job again because who wants to hire somebody who's taken legal action against a company?
It's possible. When I practice in litigation with an absolutely wonderful law firm here in Miami, we would see from time to time certain employees who have filed several different types of claims against former employers. And there was a question of, is this a career plaintiff? Are they someone who is just looking for a lawsuit and is going to apply in various settings and you get the same lawyer that's representing the same client? And so this is relevant information if you're going to be defending against a lawsuit of this type. And so you sue at your own peril sometimes because you might be wrong or you might find yourself out of work permanently.
With the new social media, can there be any impact about medical information and records?
100%. So HIPAA governs the use of patient-related information. So there's a real difficulty with hospitals and doctors.
Why they'll never send a fax to you.
Of course. Now, the interesting issue we have is that obviously doctors and medical practitioners are not generally going to make a mistake by taking a picture of a patient, for example, or sending specific patient information, although it does happen. The question becomes, when a doctor or nurse or other medical professional or even a med professional post online and says, boy, what a rough day.
A nurse in the emergency room, for example.
Exactly. Right. And someone can read this information and say, well, you didn't say who this person's name was, but you gave me enough information to figure it out. Does that violate HIPAA? And the answer is it probably does. So there needs to be training.
And the hospital would be liable also.
They absolutely would.
The only one, probably.
Of course. And they're the one with the deep pocket and the very large insurance policy mm-hmm. that a plaintiff's attorney is likely going to sue. So doctors and medical practitioners not only need to have a policy in place, but they have to be trained so they know how it applies so that they don't just pick up their phone without thinking twice and posting something about their day that might violate HIPAA and federal medical
regulations. Or if it were a celebrity or something, so-and-so had a nose job. Or
yes.
Let me ask you this. Social media is changing all the time. New platforms are coming on the scene all the time. So how solid are these laws and these rules governing social media? Are they subject to change, like, constantly?
They are, and that's what's tough. And so we've got a legislature that maybe tries their best. I'm going to let you decide. But they cannot step in.
It may be held against you.
That's true. Is this live radio? So they can't march into session every time a new platform comes up and create a new law. So we try to apply these old laws to these new technologies. And sometimes, Bonnie, it's like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole because new stuff is popping up all the time. I think we might even be on Periscope right now.
We might. Paul Leary might have us on.
All right. So,
does he?
Broadcasting live.
Oh, okay. Well, hello, Periscopers. Periscopers? I don't know. What are they called these days?
I guess we're on a submarine.
All right. Okay. So I want to, there's so much more questions, you know, technical stuff that I'd like to know, but I want to know why you went from private practice to becoming a professor.
Well, I realized that my time in life is uncertain and short, and so we don't get to spend all of our time in life doing the things that we love. I absolutely worked for an amazing law firm, an amazing practice, and if I wanted to be one of the world's greatest trial lawyers, I would have loved to have stayed there and continued to learn and do that work. But what I realized is that my passion in life was teaching, public speaking, helping other people, giving back, and so that's why, in addition to having my own law practice now and a consulting company that helps train employers on these issues, I spend my time teaching at Nova Law School, writing books and giving back, and operating a charity called Let's Plant a Seed, which is hopefully to help inspire other people to say, you should be spending more time in life doing what you love, and then whatever it is that you like doing, spend your time giving back and making the world better than how you found it.
We just want to say that the website, Ethan's website, socialmedialawandorder.com, socialmedialawandorder.com, and you can find out all about him, and Let's Plant a Seed there, right? Okay.
Okay, we'll take a quick call. This is David in Delray. Hi.
Hi, this is David. I had a question that's unrelated to employment, but relates to Facebook. There are various groups. Somebody would start a group, and then they would allow people to join that group. And I'm wondering if the group administrator could be held liable for a libelous post that's put up there by somebody else in the group. Because the group mm-hmm. administrator has some responsibility to monitor what's on that Facebook group page.
Great question,
yeah.
David.
Yeah, good.
And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to invite you into my class next semester and pose this question to students because this would be, in my opinion, a question of first impression. So it is clear under the law that an employer has a responsibility for what their employees do during the course and scope of their employment. But I've yet to see a law that would extend those same responsibilities to the operator of a Facebook group. And so there are lots of laws that will insulate internet service providers from liability when somebody says something bad on their site. And what that means is if someone puts a comment onto Facebook, for example, that might be defamatory, you can't hold Facebook liable for that because they'd be liable for what millions of people could potentially say. And I think that the same protections would likely apply to someone who is operating a group. So unless that person in the group contributed to that statement or maybe shared that statement on their social media profile mm-hmm. and then potentially became liable for disseminating it, I have yet to see a law that would hold the administrator of a group responsible for what their members say.
But shouldn't the administrator, if there's a libelous or slanderous comment on that, shouldn't they delete it?
Well, they may. And so there is a question of, do they have to and should they? And
right.
Discretion is always the better part of valor. We don't want to hurt people's feelings. We want to use social media to connect and share information and bring people together. So you might want to say, is it worth a lawsuit, even if I might ultimately win by keeping this up? Once you have somebody whose feelings are hurt, of course, it's a great idea to consider taking it down, because the benefit of having that post probably doesn't outweigh all the trouble that can come with it.
Well, wish we had longer. You'll have to come back.
I'd love
okay.
to. Thank you.
I'm going to be very careful.
Yes, that's the moral of the story. Ethan Wall is an author, attorney, social media legal expert, consultant, and adjunct professor of social media and the law at Nova Southeastern University. He's written Fire Over Facebook. You ready for this? A primer on protected social media activity in the workplace and best practice guide for managing employee social media use.
That is a mouthful.
Okay, and the website, Social Media Law and Order.com. Thanks so much, Ethan.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Food and Dining is next.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Well, it used to be that when we thought of French food, the first thing that would not come to our mind was healthy. But it seems that times have changed, and so have French-inspired meals. Well, when I say that, joining us first is the chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend Linda Gassenheimer. Welcome, Linda.
Well, Bonnie, I was going to say nice to be with you.
No, but what I mean is, because it was always so rich in the sauces and the butter.
I
and
thought
that.
You were going to say that we don't think about was kids.
Oh,
kids,
well, that
food.
Too, kids. Well. Okay, so what's on our healthy menu today?
Okay, what's on our plate? Well, you might think, you know, chicken nuggets or fries when you're talking about kids' food. But how about a French quiche, or maybe a salad with vinaigrette? Well,
escargot.
Oh, well, for kids, well, let's see.
I don't think so, Joe.
Well, Kids Cook French. That's a charming book by our guest, Claudine Pepin. Now, you've seen Claudine cooking on TV with her father, the world-famous chef Jacques Pepin, and she's here to give us tips on cooking French style and eating together as a family. So let's welcome Claudine Pepin.
Hello, Linda. I'm cracking up over here. Kids love escargot.
Oh, wow.
Butter and garlic. Who doesn't like anything smothered in butter and garlic?
If you're from the Midwest.
The bread. And lots of kids eat, and they grow up in France, and they're healthy, and they eat French food all the time.
There you go, Bonnie.
And they probably drink wine. But
and they well, they it. Certainly they certainly drink a lot more water usually than we drink here. But the butter and the cream and all of that is generally reserved for more restaurant cooking.
There
home
you
cooking
go.
In France is very light and clean.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, let's bring in our listeners. Do you have a favorite family meal, or do you ever sit down and eat together as a family anymore these days? Or questions or comments, give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN, and email.
That's radio at WLRN.org.
Well, thank you very much.
I do something.
Right? Hello, Joe. Nice to be with you.
Indeed.
Okay, and also with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Now, Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns, and you can read Fred's wine column in the Miami Herald. It's on Saturday now. Fred, what are we drinking today? I guess I can guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, while all of those kids are cooking French, their parents are probably sitting back with their feet up drinking French wine. And that's what I'm going to talk about.
All right. Sounds good. Claudine Pepin, first of all, congratulations. This is your first book, Kids Cook French.
Yes. I'm thrilled.
Well, it's a delightful book, and I love it because it's a family affair. And there are drawings by your father. He's a wonderful artist, Jacques Pepin. And also, Shori, your daughter, had some drawings in the book.
Yes, she absolutely did. I admit freely that I bribed her. I said, I said, if you make nice drawings, Mommy will pay you $5 for each drawing that makes it into the book. Now I have to negotiate on whether or not the repeats count. Like, is that a one drawing, or if it's repeated, does she get $5 more than once?
Well, I'll talk to her. I think she should get it every time it's repeated.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so another thing I love about the book is that each recipe has a family story. And I love the one about how you made spinach and bechamel sauce for your father and what mm-hmm. he said. Tell us about it.
Well, we were doing a photo shoot. It was my first photo shoot for House Beautiful. And I went and we made the bechamel, and I put the spinach directly into the bechamel. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, obviously, I don't know. He goes, you can't do that. You have to cook it first. And I said, why? And he said, oh, I don't know why. So we've all made it that way ever since.
Well, let's first explain, Claudine, some people may not know what a bechamel sauce is. It's basically a white sauce.
Yes.
And what your father was talking about was cooking the spinach first before it went into the sauce.
Right.
So now you just threw it all together.
Yes.
And he likes
it. It's much easier. You only dirty one pot, which I am a big fan of, only dirtying one pot. And it tastes wonderful.
Well, that sounds great. Well, talking about family cooking, I remember a great tip from your mom, Gloria. I'm not sure you remember this, but I was visiting Gloria, and you asked how to make broccoli taste good. And her answer, steam it and pour some oil infused with a little saffron over it. And I've used that tip a lot. It's real simple and easy.
Yeah, that sounds good. I thought the answer was going to be cook it all the way.
Oh, I see. Okay. Apparently, you were having somebody special over for dinner and needed that right away.
Oh, I'm sure. That was the best hotline ever.
Okay. Well, these recipes are French in your book, and some of the recipes seem difficult. I mean, I mentioned earlier the quiche. Doesn't seem easy, but you say they're really simple. So explain that to us.
Well, I don't see. I mean, go to the store and buy puff pastry.
Oh, so we can buy the pastry.
Exactly.
Joe, there you go.
Dinnerandminutes.com.
you buy the puff pastry and roll it out, and you mix some stuff together and pour it in. It's really easy.
Okay, so but you have to put the puff pastry into the pie plate.
Well, Claudine, where do you draw the line in terms of what kids can do? Are there recipes that they really can't do?
Well, I think that it really depends on the kid. I wouldn't say that this is the cookbook that you hand to the six-year-old and say, good luck. This is family cooking. This is families cooking together. And just about every recipe has something for all the hands in the family to do. And for me, that's the fun of it. It's not fun to cook by yourself. At least I don't think so. I like cooking when there are other people in the kitchen, and we're talking, and we're having fun, and so it's not only bringing families hopefully together at the table, but bringing them together in the kitchen to cook together as well.
And Fred, see, you could cook together with your little French wine there.
Yeah,
that's right.
Oh well, that's essential.
Yeah, sometimes I even add the wine to the recipe.
There you go. Okay, so talk about how to cook together and all. You have wonderful tips throughout the book. And so let's talk about some of them. One I thought was interesting, you said something about you leave chicken uncovered in the refrigerator to dry out the skin. So why do we do that?
It makes the skin crispier when you roast it because now you've already dried it out. In a lot of Asian cooking, what happens with a classic Peking duck and even the mock Peking duck that I do is that the duck is steamed first, and that renders the fat. And then it's dried out, and then it's roasted, and then you have that skin that you can knock on like you would knock on a door, and it makes sound. But if you leave a whole chicken out, it air dries the chicken and just gets crispier.
So you would leave it out in the refrigerator?
Yeah. It's not going to jump on anything. I mean, I know people think bacteria, but it's really not going to do. It's just sitting there. Unless you touch it and touch other things, it's perfectly safe.
All right. So our number is 800-743-9576 if you'd like to join us and talk with Claudine Pepin or give us your tips or when you sit down to cook with your family. Another tip you gave us I thought was interesting was that you should only use unsalted butter. Now, we see both salted and unsalted in the market. Now, why should we use unsalted?
Unsalted butter, you can taste if it goes rancid. Salted butter is delicious, and I don't say I don't like taking salted butter and putting it on a piece of bread, but first of all, you're going to season the food, and you'll add salt and pepper, so it's probably best to not add more salt so that you control your own quantity of seasoning. And also, salted butter, salt being a preservative, it's sometimes difficult to tell if that butter is rancid.
Well, I noticed,
and that can make for some upset tummies.
Right. I noticed when I lived in France that the French would only use unsalted because I think they didn't trust it otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And generally, we don't refrigerate our butter in France as much as butter is refrigerated in the States, but also we go through a quarter pound of it a day.
There you go, Bonnie, you know, with your right. Healthy not healthy. Okay, so one more thing was, I love this, put a sheet tray in your oven underneath whatever you're cooking. It really helps to keep your oven clean.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. a good idea.
Yeah, see, Bonnie, there you go.
Otherwise, yeah, I mean, I don't like to clean up. I don't have little magical people that come and clean up my kitchen when I'm done. I cook something, I soak it as quickly as I can. If I'm baking something, it goes on a sheet tray so it doesn't splash all over. Even a roasted chicken. I'll take that and I'll put that on an even bigger sheet tray.
That doesn't change the temperature in the oven or anything?
No, everything gets nice and hot.
I'd like to know when Bonnie last turned her oven on.
Now, that's not fair.
How about you, Joe?
I was just saying, in theory.
I made biscuits the other night.
Oh, I love biscuits.
Okay. Well, and also, the book is written in both French and English. It's English on one side of the page and French on the other. Why did you do that?
Well, it was at the request of the publishing house. I believe that they are hoping that this will be the first of many series done, not only in French, but in Spanish and Italian, and I'm hoping for Mandarin, personally. So this was just the very first one.
When you
and
say
I think it's a great tool for French teachers.
Right. Why are you hoping for Mandarin, Claudine?
Because I love any kind of Asian food.
Oh.
And I would never be able to have a clue as to what was written, but I think it would look lovely.
Oh. Okay, I think I'm laughing because I know your father told me once, he says, when I was telling him about I love Chinese food, he says, well, I don't like it at all. So I'm glad that you got some Chinese food when you were younger.
I did. Oh, yeah.
We have a caller here on line one, Andre. Andreas, in Coconut Grove, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you guys for having me. I have a few questions.
Go ahead.
Recently stopped working at a French restaurant, and I'm new to cooking in general, and there's a few dishes that I'm trying to learn how to replicate. And the one that I really had a big question on is how to prepare a proper beef tartare. How should I do that?
A beef tartare.
A beef yep. tartare. Well, let's ask Claudine. Do you make that, Claudine?
I don't usually make that at home. I think that there are several recipes that you can find. I would check Epicurious. I would check Jacques Pépin's Essential Pépin and several others. But the only hesitation I have with anybody trying to do this at home is that you have to make sure that that piece of meat is in the most pristine condition possible.
Right.
Because
right.
the bacteria won't be on the inside. It's never on the inside. It will be on the outside. So that's really number one. And if you have a great piece of beef and you're comfortable with that, I would hand chop it
right.
as opposed to trying to put it through any sure. kind of grinder. If you hand chop it, it will be lighter, it will be a bit fluffier, and you can control it much better. Also, one of the best ones that I've had used a duck yolk from a duck egg.
Oh, wow.
As opposed
well,
to
on that,
a chicken
on that
egg.
Note, Claudine, that sounds delicious. I think you're the most important point you mentioned was make sure you have a good piece of meat.
Yeah, and
but
of
we have
course,
to take.
You know,
we're going to have to take a break now.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call, Andreas. I hope that helped. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Claudine Pepin about her book, Kids Cook French. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Claudine Pepin about her book, Kids Cook French. She's been giving us tips on how to cook and how to eat as a family and how to enjoy really good French food with ease. But right now, we have dinner in minutes time. So, of course, I had to make a French one, an easy, quick dinner in minutes. And this is steak au poivre, that's steak with pepper sauce with garlic, rosemary, potatoes. And this is a steak dinner that won't break your calorie bank or your time bank. And it's a family pleaser. So I press cracked black pepper into a steak. I'm using tenderloin, but any quick cooking steak, sirloin, flank, skirt steak can be used. And then brown the steak in the skillet a couple of minutes aside. And then I take it out of the skillet, the steak, and I add some chopped shallots. But if you want, you can add onion, chopped onion. Some garlic and mushrooms to the skillet, and I saute that a few minutes. I put the steak back into the skillet, and of course we have to have some brandy there. Cook that for a few seconds, remove it all, and then I add a little cream. I finish the sauce, put the sauce over the steak. It's simple and easy. And the potatoes, even easier, because I make them in the microwave. And I could cut them all into about 1-inch pieces, microwave them for a little bit, take them out, add a little garlic, return it to the microwave, so maybe 5 minutes, just test to make sure that the potatoes are cooked through. Sprinkle some oil and rosemary over them. That's your dinner in minutes, the complete recipe and a photo. It can be found at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
I think that one of the most popular French wines with Americans is Beaujolais Nouveau, or in other words, New Beaujolais. On the third Thursday of November each year, it's officially released, becoming the very first wine from that year's vintage. That's why the celebrations are appropriate. And it does arrive with great fanfare. And Linda, you probably remember this. One year in Miami, they flew it in on the Concorde and brought it in by helicopter, pardon me, to the Grand Bay Hotel in Coconut Grove, where it was greeted with well-dressed partygoers and fireworks. So they made a really big deal about it.
Okay.
So that's great.
I remember that. I do. I mean, I wasn't allowed to drink then. Must have been like 5 years ago. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
I do remember that. Beaujolais Nouveau is a huge deal.
Yeah, in France too, I gather.
Yeah. Yeah,
so anyway, it's great fun, but still, Beaujolais Nouveau is a simple wine, really.
Yeah,
it's vinified very quickly from the grape called Gamay, so it's light and bright and fruity, but not really a serious wine. It's always drunk within a year of the harvest or even sooner.
Right.
I think fewer people know that there are more serious forms of Beaujolais. These Beaujolais non-Nouveau wines are fermented longer and made fuller and fruitier and with more tannin, and released only a year or two after the harvest, like other serious wines. And they can even benefit from 2 to 4 years of aging. Now, in this category, the first level is Beaujolais Village, made in one of the 39 top villages in the Beaujolais region south of Burgundy. And the top level is Cru Bourgeois, made in one of the 10 top Beaujolais villages, with names like Fleury and Moulin-Avant, and some of these will age up to 10 years. Joseph Durand makes a particularly good one, I think. Now, these are full-bodied, crisp, with flavors of tart strawberries and cherries. And to me, they're the perfect wine for a picnic of French charcuterie, which is made of various cheeses, preserved sausages, and the wonderful French pickle called cornichons. And, of course, with a crisp French baguette bread. And, you know, actually, this is all making me hungry, and I would propose a picnic, but I hear it's 97 degrees down there in Miami these days. Is that true?
Not today.
No, not today.
We had rain, so it cooled off.
You guys are frying down there.
No. Claudine, were you trying to say something?
No, I said that sounds so delicious. I'll be right there. That
okay.
Sounds like the perfect thing to have.
Sounds good.
Although I love rosés, and I'm trying to get friends to drink more rosés.
Yeah, I do that. Well. I write a column every year trying to get people to drink rosé. It's kind of an uphill battle.
Yeah. Yeah, they think it's white Zinfandel. It's not. I promise.
I know. They ought to sue those guys.
Right, Claudine Pepin, You and your father are just finishing or about to finish a new TV series. It's the 13th series, and this is the final one. So tell us a little bit about it.
This series is Jacques Pépin's Heart and Soul, and it will start to air on PBS in the fall, I believe late October, early November, with, of course, a companion book, Heart and Soul, although he didn't like the name. He really didn't like the name because he said, oh, because I don't put my heart and soul into everything, just this one? He goes, let's just call it Liver and Gizzards. Same thing. I said, okay. Well, I don't know. It's really, you know, it's not up to me. And he was a bit frustrated, but they got him to agree to Heart and Soul. And it's going to be fun. Shori, my daughter, will be on several shows. I will be on a few shows. And my husband will even be on a couple of shows.
And your husband is a chef as well.
My husband is a chef.
I really like the way you two get along on television. It's a very interesting relationship.
It's funny. It's pretty much real life. If you come to the house, and Linda knows this, she's known me since I was, I don't know, 10 or something.
Right, we don't have to say how old, right?
So, yeah, I've heard that a long time, and that's just how we get along.
Well, you know, it is true, Claudine. It's wonderful. There's always food going on in the home. Everything's happening there. And everybody's sharing the food. And I mean, people keep saying, oh, you know, what do they make? And I've been to your home where Jacques made hamburgers.
Yeah.
Just wonderful. Of course, he did make the buns himself, but never mind. We had hamburgers. And one time I remember I used to say, well, it's hard really to buy really good food the way you can buy it in France. And he was upset with me. So he bought everything from the supermarket, including frozen meat, and made the most wonderful meal in the world.
Yes. He's also the food whisperer. He can do things with food that I don't understand. When we do a demo, something will start to boil. I'll go, oh, that's boiling. He goes, he'll look at it. He'll give it one stir and goes, no, it's not. And I'm like, how did he make it stop? He didn't lower the flame. He just stirred it once, and it stopped completely, and refuses to start again.
Right.
That's not possible.
Well, you know, the other thing is, well, talk about him. He came over our house once, and I had, you have in the book, you have no chocolate desserts, which I was surprised because he came over once, and I had just made some chocolate sauce. It was cooling on the counter, and he went over immediately, and he ate some. Mm-hmm. And I said, Jacques, that's for later. And he said, yeah, but I like chocolate. So, well, I like also the fact that you mentioned in the book that you say there's no culinary prison, so it's okay to make a mistake, even a big one. So tell me some of the mistakes you've made.
Oh, my goodness, that's a different show.
We only have 2 minutes left.
So exactly. I've made every single mistake that you can make. I mean, certainly with the microwave, talking about chocolate, I was trying to make from scratch, I'll never do it again, a bûche de Noël, and so I'm melting the chocolate.
Well, wait, first, before you go, a bûche de Noël is that wonderful chocolate log that's made for Christmas time. It's a cake.
Right.
Go ahead.
And so I'm trying to melt the chocolate to make the ganache. Well, I pushed like 3 minutes on the thing. It should have been 30 seconds, I'm sure. The thing exploded and scorched. At the same time, I'm using the KitchenAid. I put that down. I don't put the guard on. I turn it on. The flour goes and hits the ceiling. No, I've made every single mistake you can come up with.
Well, I was going to ask what mistake you've made that you could tell us how to correct.
Oh,
like if your sauce goes bad or something.
those mistakes, no, you can't correct those. I think if you overcook meat, just take it, cut it, and make something else out of it. You know, if you overcook a steak, well, then take it, cut it, and make a stew instead.
Make a stew, or sometimes, you know, I have leftover meat, and what I do is I put it in the food processor with a little mayonnaise, some horseradish, a few vegetables, and I make a pate.
Yeah, that's a great idea, too. I mean, I think that the art of recovery is really a lot of what cooking is about. I mean, you overcook the fish, so you make a soup out of it.
Right, okay. You know, we could talk on and on, but we're out of time, Claudine.
Oh.
Thank you very much. Claudine, her book, Claudine Pepin's book is Kids Cook French, and it's a delightful way and an easy way to bring the whole family together and cook.
And Linda will sign it. If you buy it, Linda will sign it. Bring it to her, she'll sign it.
Right on. Okay. Fred Tasker, thanks for your great advice.
Always a pleasure.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, great to be with you.
Likewise. Thank you, Linda.
Next week, we'll be talking with TV celebrity Ingrid Hoffman. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical support from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And tomorrow at this time, join Ed Bell for South Florida Arts Beat. Bonnie and I return Monday with Americans Against Abusive Probate Guardianship founder, Dr. Sam Sugar. Let me say that again. Americans Against Abusive Probate Guardianship, Dr. Sam Sugar. He provides an update on reforms passed during the Florida legislative session. This is Joseph Cooper for
Bonnie Berman.
Thanks for being with us today, each and every day.
Indeed, and feel better, Joe.
I certainly hope so.
And have a great weekend.
And you too. This is Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gastenheimer, Fred Tasker. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.